The date is September 22nd, 2009, and we are at the Amelia Island Museum of History, 233 South 3rd Street in Fernandina Beach, Florida. The following interview is being conducted as part of the Amelia Island Museum of History's Veterans History Project in partnership with the Library of Congress. We are interviewing Joseph Isaac Reese, born January 19, 1920, in Clearwater, Florida. My name is James McCannell, and I will interview the subject on behalf of the Amelia Island Museum of History. Assisting me is Donald Hill, who will operate the recording equipment. I will now begin the interview. Joe, what was your period of service?
I served from October 1942 until May of 1968.
Okay. And during which conflicts did you serve?
Well, I was in World War II, the Korean conflict were the only two combat type of activities.
Okay. And what was your rank?
I retired as a lieutenant colonel.
All right. Very good. And where did you serve?
In World War II, I was in the 5th Amphibian Tractor Battalion, which was forced troops. We landed the 2nd Marine Division on Saipan and the 4th Marine Division on Tinian and the 4th Marine Division on Iwo Jima.
Okay. And then where were you when you retired from military service?
When I retired from the Marine Corps, at headquarters of the Marine Corps, I spent 26 years in the service.
All right.
Well, 25 years, 6 months, and a few days.
Okay. Well, thank you. Why don't you go ahead and tell us about how you first became involved in military service and take it from there.
Well, I was in school, and I had to get a job to stay in school in those days. And I was at Clemson University, which was an ROTC school. To get my job, and so I could go back to school, I had to stay out a while, and so the ROTC would not continue to keep me enrolled. And so then that made me subject to the draft, and so I investigated and got and signed up for the Marine Corps.
Okay. And what year was that then?
That was in 1942.
Okay. And then you went to...
The Marine Corps deferred my going on active duty. The sign-up was actually for the platoon leader's class, since I was a college graduate rather than just enlisted ranks. Mm-hmm. And the platoon leader's class programs sent you to Parris Island and then to Quantico, Virginia for your officer training. And then I went from as a reserve and held me there from October of 42 to February of 43 when I went to Parris Island. And the active duty started at that time.
Okay. And did you go to some military technical school after that?
After my basic training at Quantico and commissioning, I went to the what was in those days was called the Landing Vehicle Track School in Dunedin, Florida.
Oh.
And I didn't know what it was, wondered how I got it, and somebody told me, well, you put down, you operate the farm tractor, and they run like tractors.
So how long did that last? How long was the school?
That school was approximately, as I recall, 12 weeks. And after that, I was sent to Camp Pendleton, and you were only going out to the Pacific in those days. And I started at Camp Pendleton. I went down to a training replacement unit near San Diego for a couple of weeks, and then I was back up to Camp Pendleton and assigned to the 5th Amphibian Tractor Battalion. His initial compliment.
And then from there, you went overseas? So.
From there, we went to Oahu,
uh-huh.
For staging, and that was preparing and staging for the landings on Saipan, yeah, at that point. And after Saipan, we thought we'd be coming back somewhere, but we didn't. We stayed on Saipan. Well, before that, we had Tinian landing, and then we came back on to stay on Saipan. We thought we'd go back to Maui or somewhere, but we didn't, because we landed the 4th Division on Tinian. Mm-hmm. We thought we might come back with them, but we didn't. They kept us there, and until the Iwo Jima operation, which was about 9 months later.
Now, were you commanding a platoon-sized unit at that time?
Well, we task organized, being in the amphibian tractors. We were troop carriers, and after you landed the troops, then you did a support role of that surprise. I was in the first wave, at not commanding at Saipan. I was commanding the first few vehicles on the beach at Tinian, and then I was a wave commander for Blue Beach 2 vehicles. I think it's the 25th Division, 25th Regiment of the 4th Division, landing at Iwo Jima.
When you assaulted Tinian, was there a lot of enemy artillery?
Nothing. Tinian was almost along the shore with no thing. Saipan was different. Saipan had been they'd placed well zeroed in. They started hitting vehicles and stuff on the way in after we crossed the reef. Mm-hmm. And the idea there was we proceeded with armored amphibians. We were all supposed to go in about 1,000 yards before we disembarked, but hardly anybody could get off the beach because of the fire.
Oh.
And we had had pretty severe vehicle casualties going in the water before you got on the beach. But so most of the unloading and all the armored amphibians, most of them didn't get much more than a few hundred yards at the most off the beach.
Did your vehicle get hit?
My vehicle got hit, and we had about half the casualties in the vehicle. I think it was around 18 to 20 troops in there. I was fortunate because I guess they shielded me, and my operators were in an area where they were shielded. It was back in the troop compartment where the troops were, and it just went. The shell went through and exploded, basically as it went through under the water.
Oh yeah.
And there's quite a few. I think it was 8 or 9 that were killed in that wrecking. Yeah.
How long did that last? The Tinian assault.
Saipan.
I'm sorry, the Saipan.
Saipan. I recall the heavy. Basically, most of the thing was about 3 to 4 weeks.
Mm.
Yeah.
And were you there the whole time?
I was there the whole time because after we made the landing and all the troops were ashore and the operation were proceeding inland. Then we became beach defenses, and some of our units, in fact, I had kept a platoon. My platoon was quite frequently called on for I call it beach defense. The Japanese would try and infiltrate sometimes before they got to the end around the water and derelicts and coming back down. So the job was to keep them from coming around through the water. More or less harassing type stuff.
Was there a lot of difficulty being resupplied and rearmed at that time?
Not in our particular area. Once we got a few troops in and got a little beachhead, then that pretty well diverted the attacking us in the water. Mm. And the main obstacle was, of course, the reef. And we had to make transit. The vehicles would go outside the reef and to the boats that were there, landing craft, and we'd transfer troops for the landing craft into the amphibian vehicles, as well as supplies. Most of the supplies that the vehicles do would go back to the LST and be reloaded there.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Alright. And then after Saipan, where did you go?
Well, they went over to Tinian. That was basically a shore-to-shore type operation, although we loaded aboard a ship.
Mm-hmm.
And loaded one afternoon and went in the next morning. There was a fight on the far end of the island with the 2nd Division.
Uh-huh.
And all the troops were there. The defenses were there. There was hardly any defenses where the 4th Division went in. They just practically walked ashore and started walking down the island.
So the feint worked?
Yes, it drew. Yeah. Yes, it was very good.
All right. And so then, what happened after that?
Well, we came back to Saipan.
Mm-hmm.
set up camp and waited for the next. Well, we got new vehicles coming in, and replacements began to come in. We didn't need too many replacements, and waiting on what was going to happen next. And big one, and the main problem there was keeping the troops occupied and from boredom. And so we'd have extensive movies, athletic events, and this kind of stuff. We had a good place, and we tried to get as many Navy people coming down to play softball and stuff as we could, because they always brought some pretty good beer and other stuff for us, where we were drinking Old Ironside and those kind of things.
Were you on rations at that time, or did you have hot chow?
We had hot chow, yeah. We'd been getting hot chow probably within about our people within about 5-8 days after the landing, because we weren't frontline people.
Yeah. Okay. And then where?
Well, after Saipan, we didn't have the high security there, because all our mail going out was all red, and we'd cut out stuff, so we knew where we were going. They told us about we were going to go up to Bonin Islands, little island up there, and wouldn't barely have much trouble, because it was going to, the Air Force was bombing the place, the smithereens, and they were going to get, I think, 3 to 5 days of ship bombardment, and you didn't expect too much there. They figured it'd be a pretty fierce initial fight, but there wasn't going to be too many defenses left on that island from all the bombing and stuff that went on.
Well, was that to be a staging area then?
No, that the necessity for taking Iwo Jima was to provide two things: air cover for planes possibly going on and later operations in Japan, the mainland of Japan, as well as immediately was a reserve place for crippled bombers coming back from Japan that couldn't make it all the way back to the Marianas, Tinian and Saipan.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. In fact, it's getting a little ahead of the thing maybe, but they hardly had the first little old airstrip there cleared before the first bomber came in. They hadn't filled all the holes in it.
So, were you in the initial wave at Iwo Jima?
First wave at Iwo Jima. First troop carrying wave. The first wave was armored amphibs.
Uh-huh.
And did not carry troops, and they provide cover about when the naval gunfire would start lifting. Then they would provide direct fire on the beach as they were in the water, and then the troops would be right behind the first wave. Mm-hmm. Yes.
What do you remember about that? As you were heading towards the beach?
Well, there's two things. I had to split my wave to get around. I think it was either Texas or Tennessee. I never figured out which one. And as we were gathering back around on it, they let go with a broadside on their 16-inch guns. And it sucked. Fortunately, it didn't sink our vehicles, but it sucked the vehicles that were next to the ship backwards about, I'd say, something like 5 to 10 yards. And it could have sunk them. It's just the ship, after firing, rolled, and that created a current that we couldn't propel against. And that was a little scary at that point. And then our Navy guide boat, I saw he was going to land us about 500 yards, clear off of our beach, to the adjacent beach to our left. And if we did that, we'd jam all the others coming up. And I just told my people, I broke radio silence, and told my people, disregard the Navy boat and follow me. And we started cutting over more to the right, and we landed, and then it was about 50 yards of our beach. We were on the beach from just about 50 yards off.
So then they followed you?
Yeah, they followed me.
That was fortunate.
Yeah. When I say followed, it was a line, and they when I went right, they all went right type thing.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, once you got on the beach, go ahead.
Yeah, that was getting on the beach. We were supposed to get, we knew there was going to be sand. We were told it was a sand beach, and there would be a rise back of the beach, and that we wanted to try and get up over that before we discharged our troops. One thing about Saipan, about Iwo, that's never Saipan, they didn't try and propel us before we got ashore. Their objective there was to let us get ashore and then contain us in a killing zone area rather than try to get us off. So we didn't have any, initially we had no fire going into the beach, enemy fire. And we were supposed to try, we didn't know that of course at the time, but we tried to get up over the beach and get up over the shelf type area. But it wasn't sand, it was volcanic ash. And it just tore us up. No traction whatsoever. Of my, I think it's 12 to 16 tractors in the first wave, I think only about 5 or 6 was able to negotiate and get up over that. A couple of them got buried and stuck in the sand and couldn't get out right at the water's edge. Mine did get up, and I was able to get them off up there. And just as we were turning to come back out, you always turned and went over to the flank or side of the thing to go back out. Either our wrap cable broke or came off, and our ramp fell. Couldn't get the ramp up. And we didn't want to be stuck on a beach. And my father by the name of Marshall, who was my runner and radio man, and my sergeant, Marshall got out, and the sergeant lassoed a rope around one of the corners of the ramp, and the two of them put that ramp up and tied it so we'd get back out. And by that time, we were beginning to get some shots. And we tried to repeat that process because it was an emergency means of getting ramps up. When we got back to ship, we couldn't do it. The adrenaline, the thing of the time, we had to add another man pushing up on the ramp to get it up.
Well, when you got back to the ship, were they able to get that ramp repaired?
Oh, yes. Yeah. Reattached the cable, and we were back in business.
Did that vehicle have a reverse capability? In other words, could you back it up?
You could back it up, yes. Yeah. On land, and you could back it up in water, but it hardly would move. It didn't have that kind of propulsion.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. So once you got the thing repaired, did you make additional sorties to the beach?
I didn't. I was aboard ship directing the loading of the emergency supplies there per whatever orders came in to the order on the loading. And I think it was the third or fourth day before I was ordered to go ashore. Stay ashore, yeah.
And what was your initial impression then of Iwo and what was happening there?
Well, it was you could tell there was a fight, and the amount of way they changed things. We stopped, for instance, taking in rations. We were taking in ammunition and barbed wire and water. And when I say stopped, the priorities went to ammunition.
Sure. First things first.
Yes. And so you knew that they were getting things. And we combat load the LSTs. We had the stuff, so initial about 3 to 4 days supply of stuff there. Mm-hmm. But that would be before you'd get to the general unloading where they could beach larger ships. Yeah.
Okay.
And that we cleared out all our stuff, and then that was ordered to go ashore. Yeah.
And how much time then did you spend on EWO?
We landed on the 19th of February, and I think it was around, if I'm not mistaken, around the 22nd or 3rd of March. I'm not sure exactly on that date, but it was toward the end of March. Okay. And we were back aboard ship, I know, and well underway for about a couple of days when the 1st of April. Yeah.
Okay. And when was it that the island was actually secured by the Americans? Do you remember? That was probably a little bit later than that, I guess.
It was in March.
Was it March?
Oh, yes. Oh,
okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. It was within a few days of when we were pulled off. Yeah.
Well, once they got you back aboard ship,
we were back loaded with 4th Division troops.
I see.
We thought we'd be going back to Saipan.
And where did you go?
We found out when we got on there, after we got on there, that we were going back to Hawaii, Maui. Because we had the 4th Division troops, and that's where they were going to. And that was a surprise to us. We didn't have, except what we had carried with us, and all of our rear echelon stuff, and most of our clothing, camp gear, all that stuff was back on Saipan.
Hmm.
We thought.
But still, that had to be a pretty pleasant surprise to find out you're going back to Maui instead.
Yes,
of
it was.
Going on to another combat situation.
One thing that impressed you, while we were there, and I'd like to mention while we were on EWO, we were able to get some fairly good rations.
Mm-hmm.
And the tank people would come back and bivouac near us, maybe sometimes at night, and they were all bloodied up and all this stuff, and been on their lines for several days. And we'd go up and ask them to come down. We'd give them some of our rations that we were getting. They were saying how they didn't want to be in our outfit because it was, we'd catch it. And they were the ones that were really catching. It was amazing, but they appreciated the rations. And then the other thing was, we were back aboard the ship, ready to sail out when they started loading the troops from the beach that had been into combat. And there's nothing could be, I still sort of get tears in my eyes when I think about how those people, when they came up, the net and got on that ship, they literally would kiss the deck.
So happy they were to be.
Oh, yes.
No, I believe that.
Yeah.
I know that was a bad situation.
Yeah.
So once you're heading back to Maui, and did you actually go to Maui?
Yes, we went to Maui.
Oh, okay.
After we got underway, the ship put out a bulletin, welcomed everybody aboard and all that stuff, and gave us some routines and gave us our destination. Well, the infantry people, they knew it, but then we knew it officially. And we were in a convoy, so we made pretty good time. I can't remember the exact date we got back to Maui. When we got there, we found out that they had arranged that our rear echelon, which had been on Saipan, had been moved to Maui.
Oh.
Yeah.
So all of your equipment and everything is now back on Maui.
We didn't know it till the next day when the truck, we pulled in there about 4 o'clock, I guess, in the afternoon. And they said they wouldn't start any unloading till the next day. And I happened to, I don't know why, but I'd rolled up a set of khakis, and since I had a vehicle, I didn't have to carry it, and stuck them in some little tarp I had in the vehicle to take up the EWO. Now, why would I do that? I don't know why I did it. But then when we got loaded this back, I took that with me, and when we got back to Maui, I was the only fella in my outfit that had a Liberty uniform, because the ship captain said if anybody has a Liberty uniform, the units could let them go ashore if they wanted to go ashore. I had everything but the shoes.
But you went anyway.
You actually thought there might be an opportunity to use those on Iwo.
I thought we might have dancing girls on the beach instead of bill boxes.
That's hilarious.
Always prepared.
So when you're on Maui now and kind of recuperating there, how long until they get you going for another operation?
Well, we were scheduled to go, we figured Honshu.
Uh-huh.
The next operation is going to be Japan. It's mainland of Japan. And as I understand it, the best information I had at that time, there was going to be 6 Marine divisions. All divisions would be committed to that operation. And we started getting a new design vehicle called the LVT-3 at that point for that operation, and we started training with that. And that was, in April. And then President Truman got that atomic bomb dropped. There was no sadness in our unit.
I guess not.
Everybody was shouting hooray. And undoubtedly, that was one of the gutsiest things any president ever had to do. But it certainly saved numerous American lives as well as Japanese lives.
So you were on Maui when that occurred?
On Maui, in August. Yep.
I bet there was a lot of jubilation there.
Absolutely jubilation. Mm-hmm. And, of course, things... then everybody wanted to go home. And I'd applied to be a regular Marine somewhere back along the line. Mm-hmm. And I had enough points to have been in the first group going out. But because I'd applied for the regulars, I was the last. About being sent back. I didn't leave Maui till December of 45, I think it was.
December 45.
Yeah.
So did they give you a leave at that time? In other words, did you be able to go back to your home? And
No. Well, when I was ordered back in December, yes, I got leave. And it was ordered to Camp Lejeune. And I was given 30 days leave, and plus it is in there that I had additional leave that I could apply for. All told, I'd accumulated, I think, in those days you'd accumulate 90 days leave, plus I had 30 days current. I could have taken 120 days leave. I think I took about, if I'm not mistaken, around 100 before I went back to camp, Lejeune.
So how long were you stationed at Lejeune?
That was only about 8 weeks. I got to Lejeune. I believe it was around May.
What, was that a training situation for you?
Well, I didn't. I thought I'd be going to amphibian tractor unit there.
Yeah.
But since that was for specialty, no, I went in what was called a specialist training regiment, which had Colonel Chester Puller as a CO. Mm. And he saw in my record that I'd been the special service officer's additional duty for the 4 battalions that were on Maui. And so he says, your duty is special service officer. And then you also, I was the guest in charge of the screening of what we call the Mustangs, the temporary officers. Their permanent rank was enlisted or warrant officer. And maybe they were majors or captains or whatever through your wartime promotions. And they had applied to stay in the Marine Corps and also maybe applied at what rank they would be held in the Marine Corps. And I ran the screening board for that.
Was that similar to a brevet?
I'm not familiar with brevet.
Well, a brevet is something that they used to use as a wartime assignment as an officer.
Their officers were temporary assignment. He might have been a gunnery sergeant, he might have been a platoon sergeant, or a warrant officer. And he was a temporary commission. And after that, he'd gotten promotions, maybe up to captain.
I see.
We had a few majors that were temporary, they'd been warrant officers.
Huh.
And
Yeah. We're ready.
Yeah, our specialist training regiment, Captain Shield, in addition to all doing what that, well, of course, I had somebody that had to have a softball team as the season was starting for that. And I had fellows managing the softball team go out there, and we were losing games 0 to 20 and 0 to 10, and lost two or three games. Chesty was the type of person that he was hands-on, and he didn't like to lose. And so he called me every morning. I'd have to go in after a game, and he wanted to know how it come out, because he'd come by there and things would look miserable. I'd have to go in and report, well, we lost again. One day, he said, after about two or three times of that, he said, what does it take to win? I said, well, we need a pitcher. We don't have any softball pitcher. He said, well, who's the best pitcher? I told him the name of a fellow. He was out at what's called Munford Point, and he worked in the mess hall out there. He's a sergeant in the mess hall. The next day, we had a new sergeant in our mess hall and a new softball pitcher.
So he was pressed into service.
Pressed into service, and we won our first game. I went into Chester the next day, and he called me. I had to go in, and he said, how'd you make out? He was by there. I said, how'd you make out? I said, we won, Chester. He says, fine. Keep up the good work. Okay. But another thing about Chester, the type of person he was, he found a sergeant, mess sergeant, coming out of the mess hall one time, loaf of bread in his hand. He said, where are you going with that, sergeant? I said, I was taking it home, sir. There was no longer a sergeant.
Oh, yeah.
He didn't put up for anything like that.
Well, that's good. So then, now how long were you stationed at Camp Virginia?
I think it was June, if I'm not mistaken. I was received orders to go up to Quantico to administrative school, which trained you to, supposedly schooled you to be battalion adjutants, regimental adjutants, personnel people. And after that, I got, since I was staying in the Marine Corps, I got orders out of there to go back out to Camp Pendleton, which had been my first choice when they sent me back from the war of where I wanted to go. And I got to Camp Lejeune instead, of course. And I got in out there, and I reported. I thought, my goodness, I'm getting back to the West Coast. Nice outfit out here, away from what we call Swamp Lejeune in those days. And I go in and report to the CO, and he says, don't unpack, Joe. We're moving out and going to Guam in 3 weeks.
Wow.
So I was back in the States, I think, from December, and we left to go back out to Guam in August.
This was in 45.
That was in 46.
46.
We got into 46 then.
All right.
Yep. Mm-hmm. So I spent, I guess it was about 18 months on Guam after the war. And they were rebuilding and that kind of thing. And we went out as the 1st Armored Amphibian, 1st Amphibian Tractor Battalion. And while we were out there, they redesignated us as a company of that battalion and attached us to the Marine Brigade, which moved to Guam out of China after the war. They had left the Marine Brigade in China, and they came out to Guam, and we became attached to this unit. Our job there on Guam was collect all the LVTs and armor and cargo type vehicles and do one of three things with them. We'd either junk them, declare them surplus, which then they could be sold to the Taiwan Chinese, or we would recondition or send them so they'd be ready for combat, or send them back to Barstow for reconditioning.
What were living conditions like on Guam then?
They were pretty good. We had Quonset huts, or prefab type huts, everything was fine. The married people, if they built their own quarters from materials that were furnished, they could have their dependents come out.
Oh.
So the singles would help the marriage build their quarters. Two things you had to have. You had to have a toilet, and you had to have a cooking facility. And the big problem was scrounging or getting hot plates. You'd get two hot plates, two burner hot plates. We could put them together and we made the stoves out of those. And the main thing was getting toilets that you could flush and have for that. But so
they actually had running water?
We had running water, yes. They had sewer systems and all. Mm-hmm. The main thing was there was nobody to build quarters for married people. They'd give a married man this was the Marine Corps. The Air Force had always a little better shape. They did up there, Navy too. But the Marine Corps, they gave them Quonset hut.
Uh-huh.
Here's your Quonset hut. Here's these basic materials. From there on, it's you.
Uh-huh.
And we'll get it put together. Get it made. You had to take, they had screen wire, but we had to get what you call hardware wire because of rats and reinforce the screen wire because the rats out there would just go right through the screen wire. I think they eat it for food almost.
Wow.
But our job was there. It was basically to recondition, rebuild the vehicles. And the first 100 we put in storage there for our possible use, and the rest we sent back to Barstow over there. And then in the latter part, we had good communications in our outfit because every vehicle had radios. And so we established a ham radio station there, and was one of our people. And we did phone patches back to the country for individuals who wanted to try and talk to their families, or we'd send messages relayed through the ham radio system.
Oh yeah, well that
back,
was nice.
Back to the States. And I'm just trying to think about the last 2 to 3 months after the brigade was back. Everybody except myself, who was operating the radio station, one of the operators, had to move over to the other side of the aisle with the brigade, but we got to stay over in our places that we'd been at. Then I got dispatch orders in to go to Georgia Tech as an ROTC instructor. I didn't know, had no idea what that was, and everybody started wondering, how in the hang did you get that, Joe?
Were you married at the time?
I was not married at the time, no. And so I got dispatch orders back to Georgia Tech. That was in 1948, I think.
That was different, wasn't it?
It was different. I didn't know what it was, didn't know what it entailed. My CO was making Georgia, a fellow by the name of Colonel Lawrence, and he says, Joe, you're going to enjoy it. Before I came back, I sent a message to my mother and father. When I arrived back in the States, please try and have me a black Mercury convertible with white top. And Lawrence said, Joe, that's going to be a big mistake. You're going to Georgia Tech, Atlanta, Georgia. He said, Marine lieutenant there with a convertible right after the war. Those Georgia girls are going to think you've got money and they all want to marry you. Not true.
Were they able to get that car for you?
They had it carved. He did work some kind of shenanigan, and I don't know what, but I had a 49 Mercury convertible when I got back there waiting on me.
Wow, wow.
And he worked with some dealership in Greenville, South Carolina, where he's from. And it was there for me. And sure enough, that was in 48. In May, March of 49, I'd met the girl and we got married. But she wasn't barefoot.
So how long did you teach ROTC?
I was there 3 years, on the ROTC unit. And then from there, I went to junior school, junior level school, which is for captains and majors. And, well, Korea had started. So we knew that when I left there and finished school that I would be going to Korea. And so after I finished the school, that was in 52, I went to Korea. And I did not go over there with a unit. Went over with a replacement unit. The route there was, of course, you went to Camp Pendleton, and the chosen reservoir had occurred at that point, and the Marine Corps initiated special cold weather training for all troops going over there, which was up from Bridgeport, California, in the snow country, about 6,500 feet elevation, and you had to go through a 4 or 5 day indoctrination up there before you went to Korea. And we did that and took a replacement unit out. We went to Sasebo, Japan, a ship, then down by train through the tunnel to Nagasaki. And then, if you never live, you hope you never have to do it. We went by Korean operated boat between Nagasaki and Busan, and it was not a pleasure trip. The accommodations in there were tatami mats run in circles around the ship, and you got your tatami mat for the voyage over, which was overnight, and the bath facilities were a big trough at the stern of the boat.
Just hang it over the stern.
First class. And then from there in Busan, the rear of the Amtrak battalion, which I was assigned to, they took the troops that were going as replacements off my hands, and the division was already up, had landed in Incheon at that point. And the division was on the Panmunjom corridor. And the troops were sent there and a train over there. And I was sent over to Maison, where the rear echelon of the battalion was. And getting there, and we moved up about 3 to 4 weeks after that. Then we were moved up to the Munsonee area. I was at on the Panmunjom corridor.
Now, what was your job at that time?
Well, once I joined the battalion, initially, I was made the S3 of the battalion. And once we got up to the whole battalion up at Munsonee and all together, a fella came and senior me by the name of Blatty, Bill Blatty, and he was made S3 and I was made the S4, my district officer. And we became very good friends. We worked well together. I guess about 3 or 4 months before I left to come back, they gave me a company up in the line up there. But we were primarily, we're not in the, what you call, we were protecting the division, I'll say we were protecting the division's left flank from roughly the Panmunjom Road and corridor along the face, and we had the Injun River between us and the North Vietnamese. Mm-hmm. I mean, North Koreans.
North Koreans, yeah.
got a battle ahead of us here. And where our main problem was line crossers swimming the river, trying to come through, filtrate back. And that was our primary purpose, was to stop that, as well as the South Koreans coming up and getting in front lines. They were trying to tend rice paddies and stuff up in front.
Oh, you mean the civilians?
Yeah, civilians.
Oh.
And they didn't care whether they got shot, didn't seem to care whether they got shot at or not, but they, because food is paramount to them, you know.
Yeah.
If they could grow something, they'd try to get to that area and grow it. So we had to keep them back. That was a big problem.
Yeah.
And after Korea, I came back and I was, did duty at as the Marine Corps Equipment Board at Quantico, Virginia, and had 3 years of that. And then I went out and was inspection acceptance officer, FMC Corporation, Riverside, California. From there back to headquarters, Marine Corps, as ordnance officer for the supply department, which is providing all the ammunition, maintenance, and vehicles, supply, that type of things. And then I got sent back out to Okinawa. It's an unaccompanied tour to Okinawa. I thought I'd get the battalion out, the Amtrak battalion there, but I didn't. I was assigned to the Force Supply Regiment out there, and was CO of the ASD Battalion, Automatic Supply Distribution, food, rations, and ammunition, and supply. And after that, I came back to Oceanside, California, and I was CO of the experimental and test unit there, and Colonel Treadwell came out from headquarters of Marine Corps and said, Joe, we want to make a new vehicle for Marine Corps. What we have is just too old, too costly to operate and everything else. I want you to come up with what you would like to see, and we have a new vehicle. And we had a civilian engineer there by the name of Stan Fuller, who had worked with back in earlier days out of NAS ships when I was at headquarters, Marine Corps, and also the equipment board. We got together, drew up specifications of what we wanted the vehicle to do, and gave it to Colonel Treadwell. And he said, okay, I'll get this approved. And he looked it over and said, I'll get this approved, and I'm going to establish a special section in headquarters of Marine Corps to do this program. And said, you will be coming to headquarters of Marine Corps to do it. And said, we want this fellow Stan Fuller to come back and be your engineer. Well, to go back there, we had to give Stan a civil service rating to get him primed loose. I think we gave him got him a GS, if I'm not mistaken, 17 or 18.
Wow.
Which puts him at about what you call a rank of a colonel or lieutenant, a brigadier general, you know, as far as in a general hierarchy of things. But he was a fellow with a golden pen. And he was a good engineer, and we knew what he'd do. And so I went back, and I was headed up the section, Stan Fuller. I was Lieutenant Colonel. Theoretically, from an overall pecking order, he would outrank me, but he was not in charge. He would be a civilian. And I had a fellow by the name of Major Bob Keller. And the three of us, and Therndip, we started what was going to be the LVT-P7 program development. And we went out for contract bids. And over the next 3 years, the successful bidder on that was FMC Corporation. And that vehicle is still in use today.
Really?
With modifications, rebuilds, upgrades, and they're still using it. And it's first introduced in 1969 in the troops.
And you're responsible for it.
I was responsible. It was my. If anything else, you said it was my baby.
Yeah. Well, that's great.
Of course, what they have now, you wouldn't recognize it. It's more armor, more higher weapons. It's to say it's been rebuilt. We hope we designed it to rebuild at least one and maybe two times to give it a service life of 14, maybe 15 years. It's, I don't know, 69 to 2009, that's about 40 years.
Wow. And they're still using it.
And it's proved its worth, yep.
That's great.
And then I guess, I was there for 3 years and I was going to get orders, and General Van Ryzen said, Joe, I want you to stay on. I want to get the vehicle into production before you do anything. and were ready for production. And so he got me extended for a year. Vietnam had started, of course, and had been going for a couple of years. And there's only two kinds of people at that point in the Marine Corps, those that had been and those that were going. And I knew my time was out, would be up in fourth year. I'd prepared me some retirement, or request for retirement, had it at my desk. And the control officer called me and said, "Joe, you're going on the list tomorrow." I took, dated my retirement orders, took them into General Van Ryzen. I said, "General, here's my request for retirement." He said, "I'm going to get you extended for another year." I said, "General, you and I both know they're not going to extend somebody here for a second time." And he said, "I guess you're right." And he signed it. And 30 days later, I was out.
Now, were you at Quantico at that time?
No, I was at Headquarters Marine Corps.
Oh, Headquarters
Marine
Corps.
Yeah, I was a project officer on the G4 staff for the development of the LVT P7. Yeah.
Oh.
And that was basically the end of my Marine Corps career, and decided what I wanted to do or tried to do, and I thought about, I worked a little bit with real estate there on the side with a fella. My wife didn't want that. I was thinking about going back to Atlanta, and Mr. Haight, who was president, chairman of FMC, he and I worked when he was a lieutenant down in Dunedin, Florida, where they first built the first LVTs.
Uh-huh.
And we worked together, knew each other there. And then, of course, when I was at Riverside, California, he said, "Joe," he called me and said, "I thought you were coming to FMC. What are you doing in Washington?" I said, "I'm not applying. I think it'd be a conflict of interest." He said, "Well, I know you can't do certain things, having been regular, but we can arrange where it won't be a conflict of interest. And will you talk to some people if I send them to see you?" And I said, "Yeah, I'll talk." So he sent a good friend of mine that had served with, Mike Sissel, colonel in the Marine Corps, retiring out there, and a fellow named Mr. Jared, who was director of the Ordnance Division. And they came and made a proposal and talked, and I said, "Okay, we'll give it a try," and went out.
So how long did you stay with them?
I was there, worked with them for 16 years.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And then retired after that. And hung around there for 2 years. And wife and I debated whether to stay in California or come back east, where we were both from. And then, excuse me, final analysis, we came back here and viewed two trips cross country, trying to decide where we wanted to live. The rest out, Quantico, Virginia, where we spent a lot of time. And born in Clearwater, Florida, we lived over there, still had a cousin there, and where we had met up in Atlanta. And 4th of July, 1990, we sat here, a friend of ours' house on Amelia Island Plantation, 4th of July, and made the pros and cons, like a military analysis, I guess, that's some kind of analysis, move or not move, and then we made the next decision to move, and then the next decision, same process, either here, Clearwater, Florida, or Atlanta, Georgia, and we chose here.
And so you've been on Amelia Island how long?
Since 1990.
Is that right?
Yep. We spent 20 years in California. That was the longest I'd ever been in one place in my life.
Uh-huh.
Until now. One more year. If I live that long, this will be the longest I've ever been in one place. And it's been good.
So what are you doing with your time now?
Well, my time now has been playing golf and going to Clemson football games.
Okay.
And I haven't done any civic work since I retired. It's just my wife and I did traveling after we got here, because she'd never traveled much. I'd have always had unaccompanied tours, so we did traveling after we got here. And then she passed away 3 years ago, and I've just managed to stay busy since then.
Well, that's good.
Yeah.
I hope you can continue to stay busy. And you know, from what we've just heard, you've had a very distinguished military career.
Well, I've had a good military career. I've been lucky. That's the main thing. Didn't get shot up.
That helps.
And I survived. Of course, I was not on the front lines like a lot of people. But I was lucky. I had good assignments. I enjoyed, I think, the main thing, because I was in development work and that kind of stuff in the Marine Corps. And that was always interesting and challenging. And it's just a matter of luck, perseverance, and having a good time now.
Well, Joe, I want to thank you for sharing your recollections with us for the benefit of the nation. And also, I'd like to thank you for your service to our country.
Well, I did mention, I meant to mention, I forgot it, before you give me the final analysis, I did receive the Legion of Merit for my work with the LVT and getting that from the Marine Corps. That was a surprise to me. I had no idea when I went in that day to get my retirement orders, and the first thing you said, General said, I'd like to read this to you, and that's the first indication I'd had for that, so I think the Marine Corps appreciated it.
I would say so. You're to be congratulated for that.
Yeah.
Anything else that you think you need to talk about?
Not that I know of.
Well, as I say, I appreciate, and I'm sure that Don as well, we both appreciate your service to our country. And this concludes the interview with Joseph Isaac Reese.
Under an hour.
Good interview. Very good. Very interesting.